I'd like to welcome Richard Rhodes. He is the author or editor of 22 books, including The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which won a Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction at a National Book Award, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, and his new book, which will be coming out in October of 2007, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. Lots of people say that after the dropping of the first atomic bombs on Japan, everything changed, quote-unquote, everything changed. What was the nature of this change, and how was it understood and not understood by the various military establishments that started making nuclear weapons in the succeeding years?
Everything changed because for the first time in the history of the human species, I like to phrase it as a kind of a slogan, humankind invented the means of its own destruction. We finally had what militaries had been striving for a very long time, which was a weapon of so-called war that would basically destroy any enemy if used in a war situation. What we didn't realize at the time, the great and deep irony, the unintended consequence, if you will, of the discovery of how to release nuclear energy, was that that made every country completely vulnerable, because these new weapons were so relatively small, or would soon be so small and portable and relatively cheap in terms of number of people killed per dollar, that it would no longer be possible to have world-scale war. And I think the test of that has quite simply been that since 1945, there has not been world-scale war. That's not to say that the theories that were evolved later, such as deterrence, actually worked. But the point is, what changed is it became no longer possible to fight wars total wars, I should say.
Well, let's talk about deterrence. What does the word deterrence mean, and can it work in the long term?
Deterrence means simply that you have a response that is so devastating that the other side doesn't dare risk attack. Basically, it means that your response, if you're attacked, you still have enough left to attack in return in a destructive way. I think it's important for people to realize, despite all the weapons that were built all across the Cold War, that neither side ever seriously considered using them. Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it seemed that we were basically threatening the Soviet Union with a nuclear attack if they didn't remove their missiles and, as it turned out, their warheads from Cuba, I spoke to Robert McNamara, who was then the Secretary of Defense, in the course of researching this book, and he said no political decision that would have caused even one American city to be destroyed with a nuclear weapon was even remotely something that either I or the president would ever have considered. You have to balance that against the incredible arsenals that both sides built to realize that at a fundamental level, what one national security advisor called the level of existential deterrence, meaning basically the feeling in the pit of the stomach that this was something too dangerous ever to use in any military way. At that fundamental level, deterrence worked and has always worked, and no doubt always will work now that we know how to make such weapons. But at the level that the United States and the Soviet Union practiced it during the Cold War, which was to build more and more weapons to balance off each side numerically, to believe somehow that if you had more nuclear weapons than the other side, that you were somehow ahead, deterrence never really worked, because if it had at any point failed, it would have destroyed the very thing that it was supposed to be protecting. So although we found a logic for what was in fact a kind of unending arms race for at least the first couple decades of the Cold War, it was a logic that was imposed on a situation that already existed. It wasn't the basis for that situation. In fact, the first response to the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki by one of the major developers of our Cold War policy, a man named Paul Nitze, who was an assistant secretary of state later on and one of our major arms negotiators. Nitze was responsible at the end of the war as part of the Strategic Bombing Survey, a group of experts who were studying the effects of strategic bombing both in Europe and in the Pacific War, and particularly over Japan. Nitze visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki shortly after the Japanese surrender. We had, at that time, also firebombed all the major and even minor Japanese cities. And what Nitze saw was that the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not really different from the destruction of Tokyo or any of the other cities that we had firebombed. And because this, and that was because these were relatively small weapons, and it was, we only used one per city, whereas the firebombing typically was done with more than 1,000 strategic bombers, B-29s, carpet bombing cities and starting firestorms or mass fires. Nevertheless, the level of destructiveness was approximately the same. Nitze took away from that information the fallacious logic that these were not really decisive weapons, that they wouldn't lead to the end of war. And as he and President Truman and Secretary of State Dean Acheson at the very beginning of the Cold War formulated our view of how you would, from a military point of view, use nuclear weapons in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, he really didn't do the calculation that this was just one bomb and a small bomb in those Japanese cities, and that if bombs got bigger and we had more of them, the destructiveness would indeed be vastly larger than the kind of destructiveness that we had been able to do with firebombing and high explosive bombing during the Second World War. So we started out with the wrong idea. We didn't multiply that one plane with one bomb times those 1,000 planes and realize that nuclear weapons were something like a huge natural catastrophe, or would be had they been used, rather than something like a bombing campaign that could be used to take out bridges and railroad yards and tank warehouses and so forth. It was a totally different, as the scientists say, order of magnitude. And what it meant was, if these weapons ever had been used as we tried to figure out a way we could use them if we ever had to, had they been used, the destructiveness would have been much worse than our calculations.
Let's talk about the difference between a Hiroshima-scale bomb and a thermonuclear or hydrogen bomb.
The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was about the equivalent of about 15,000 tons of TNT. That in itself is an enormous explosive force. The largest TNT, high-explosive bomb, used during the Second World War, if I recall correctly, was 10,000 pounds. And we're talking about 15,000 tons. So hugely more, and yet a 15-kiloton bomb today would be considered what is called a tactical weapon, meaning one to be used on the battlefield, but one that wouldn't have been considered large enough for strategic or city-busting use. In fact, McNamara went out to the Strategic Air Command soon after he became Secretary of Defense under President John F. Kennedy, and was presented with their doctrine of how many weapons you target on a particular target. And just to get a sense of what their measurements were measuring, he said, well, how many would you have targeted on Hiroshima? And they said 380-kiloton bombs. In other words, the targeting system that we used during the Cold War was vastly more destructive in terms of its calculations, because it underestimated the bombs, than the actual destructiveness of these very small bombs we'd used during the war. So in the mid-1950s, we developed a new kind of weapon, which basically could be as big as we wanted it to be. It used another nuclear reaction called thermonuclear fusion, which was not characterized by needing what's called a critical mass, as fission bombs were. Basically, that means the more stuff you add, the more hydrogen you add to the bomb, the bigger the explosion. Edward Teller once calculated that you could probably build a deliverable weapon that would be 1,000 megatons, 1,000 million tons of TNT equivalent, really an incomprehensible number. Teller realized, however, that it would be a useless weapon because once the fireball, the central explosive part of a bomb, is larger than 10 miles in diameter, which is you get to when you've got about 100 megatons, not 1,000. Once the fireball is 10 miles in diameter, if you make it any bigger, that's the thickness of the atmosphere around the Earth. So any further explosive size would just blow out into space. This begins perhaps to give you a sense of the difference between the bombs. Destructive though they were, 70,000 people in Hiroshima killed almost immediately, 44,000 people killed immediately in Nagasaki, and that bomb was off target and not very well positioned to do what it was supposed to do. A megaton scale bomb has, well, let's take the first one. This was a device that was tested in the Pacific in November 1952. It was a test device, not really deliverable, but it yielded 10.5 million tons, megatons, of TNT equivalent. The fireball of that weapon was something like 3 miles in diameter. People who were stationed on a ship 30 miles away as observers saw the mushroom cloud rising and rising and spreading as it rose. It quickly rose to 70,000 feet, and it seemed to them from the heat on their faces of the fireball that they were right next to it. And it seemed to them to be towering over their heads. It's hard, I think, for us to even visualize the destructiveness of a megaton-scale weapon. But there are reasonable estimates that Mount St. Helens, to take one example, was a 1 or 2 megaton explosion.
And the hydrogen bomb is could be considerably more than that.
Yes, and in fact, our biggest hydrogen bombs, which were the ones that were designed to be carried on B-52s in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when our main system for delivering weapons to the Soviet Union was big strategic bombers, we had bombs that were 25 megatons. There really are no targets in the Soviet Union other than Moscow that needed such a large weapon. But the Strategic Air Command wanted the largest weapons that they could get. When we switched to delivering our weapons by ballistic missile, we then started to make much smaller weapons. There's always a trade-off between accuracy of delivery and size of explosion, such that if you've got a very accurate weapon, you don't need a large explosion. Indeed, today we're even thinking about making ballistic missiles with conventional high-explosive warheads, because with the GPS system in place in satellites around the Earth, we can deliver a ballistic missile within a foot or two of its target, 5,000 miles away. Under those circumstances, you don't need a nuclear weapon. So our explosive force, the total explosive force in the U.S. arsenal, dropped radically after 1960 as we switched over from bombs carried on bombers to warheads carried on missiles. That was later used by conservatives and hawks to argue that the Soviets had more explosive force in their arsenals than we did, which was true, but the reason for that is their missiles were not nearly as accurate as ours. So they felt they needed to have a larger warhead in order to compensate for the inaccuracy.
Well, when here's the difference between military and civilian targets, and if you have a small explosive targeting a military target, you know, one could make an argument for that. But when you're talking about the hydrogen bomb, there is no difference, is there?
No, and that was, well, you know, we spent a lot of time, our government spent a great deal of time and effort trying to not to scare the hell out of all of us about these weapons. One of the ways that our government did that was to not scare the hell out of themselves, the people who were designing the targeting systems, for example. targeting was controlled by the U.S. Air Force. There was a master plan, which was called the Strategic Integrated Operating Plan, the SIOP, and it designated the targets for every weapon controlled by any one of the military services. But in order to work with the idea that there's such a thing as a pinpoint target for a bomb that's going to destroy an area the size of a large city, you have to scale down its effects. So up until the present time, targeting plans take into account only the blast effects of nuclear weapons, which as weapons get above 50 kilotons, as most of our weapons are, even on warheads, is the least destructive part of the weapons' effects. The most destructive weapons' effect of nuclear weapons is that they start mass fires, what used to be called firestorms. To give you an example, if a 300-kiloton warhead, Soviet warhead, Russian warhead today, exploded in the air above the Pentagon, by the old way, by the present way of calculating only the blast effect, you would assume that it would destroy everything out just beyond the Capitol. In other words, a fairly small area of downtown Washington would be destroyed by blast. But if you counted the fire-starting effects of a nuclear weapon, and that's the primary effect of a nuclear weapon, a 300-kiloton warhead exploded over the Pentagon would burn out every last bit of organic matter all the way out to Chevy Chase, Maryland, and all the way south down to well below Washington City. So we were able to even comprehend the old tradition of pinpoint targeting of specific so-called military targets only by limiting what we calculated to be the effects of nuclear weapons. In a way, it was an organizational structure for making it possible to think about something so terrible. The fact is that our system was set up, if there were ever a need for a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, the Strategic Air Command planned to put everything it had in the air at the outset of any conflict, such that we would destroy not only the Soviet Union, but also all the countries of Eastern Europe, even if they weren't involved in the war, and China, and North Korea. In other words, we were just going to take out what we considered the communist enemy, as if it were some sort of vast, monolithic source of evil.
It's a form of insanity. It's a form of, what do you call it, mental illness?
Well, you call it people who have been given an impossible task, which is to figure out a way to use these terrible things, trying to figure something out that even remotely made any sense. And the only way you can do that, basically, is by looking the other way most of the time. That's what we came to when we were faced with this brand new, in truth, useless new knowledge about the natural world, which is what it was. We had found an essentially inexhaustible source of energy, and you can use it to power electrical grids, or you can use it to make weapons. But if you use it to make weapons, you're not likely to find a way actually to use them. The tragedy is that both sides, I think, the leaders on both sides understood every time a new leader took office. And I found statements to this effect from all of our presidents, from Truman forward, and from all the Soviet general secretaries from Malenkov forward. The leaders realized very early that these things were so horrible that they would never deliberately use them in any possible situation. And at that point, they just sort of wrote them off and said, all right, well, they're good for negotiating, they're good for bargaining. They let our people, paradoxically, sleep at night because we feel we're protected. And they went about their business. No one had the courage, the political fortitude, if you will, on either side, until Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan. No one had the courage to step forward and say, this is madness. We can't use these things. They're a drain on our economies. If they ever got loose, the whole world would be destroyed. The whole human world would be destroyed, which is certainly true. If the United States had indeed unleashed its full nuclear force on the Soviet Union, according to the PSYOP plan, we would have killed upwards of close to a billion people around the world. It's hard to imagine any circumstance whereby any future citizens would think of democracy other than as a horrible force of evil had we done such a terrible thing, had we felt pushed into doing such a terrible thing, because the Soviets, of course, had the same concerns and had the same armaments.
The bombs fell on Japan before I was born, but it was in my parents' lifetime. There will come a time when there's no living person who can remember the testing of the hydrogen bomb or the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan. What happens then? Do you think people need to use them or learn from their mistakes all over again?
You know, there's been a dramatic change in the whole situation in the last 10 years because of the end of the Cold War. First of all, I cannot imagine any two countries ever again conducting such an expensive and futile and dangerous nuclear arms race as we and the Soviet Union conducted over the years of the Cold War. It's sitting there in the historical record, the pointlessness, the vast expense. It certainly was part of the reason the Soviet Union collapsed. It's one of the reasons the infrastructure in America is in such terrible shape. Bridges, I mean, and schools and so on, highways. We spent $5 trillion just on our nuclear arsenal and delivery systems in the course of the Cold War. That in 1995 was exactly the national debt. So I think it's clear that we can feel a little safer today than we were in 1985. On the other hand, there was an event, I'm referring to 9/11, that put a deep, deep fear in government leaders in our country and in other countries, with the realization that there is now the possibility of subnational groups, terrorist groups, call them what you will, subnational groups that defend no territory, that have no assets that they need to protect, basically, getting their hands on or even perhaps building a homemade version of a nuclear weapon or two and using them to attack their enemies. In other words, if deterrence ever worked, it would not, theoretically at least, work against a dedicated terrorist group that's living in caves somewhere, because deterrence works on the basis that you have something you don't want to lose. Therefore, the other side's threat is something you take seriously. Governments understood that, and I think as a result, there is beginning to be a concerted consideration within governments and with former government officials of the possibility and indeed the necessity of eliminating all nuclear weapons. There was, in fact, the beginning of such a movement led by former Secretary of State George Shultz, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, former Senator Sam Nunn, announced in a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece about a year and a half ago, and ongoing now, an effort to convince this president or the next president or the one after that to go to the United Nations and say, we're prepared to eliminate all our nuclear weapons if the rest of the world will agree to do the same. So that movement is actually started and ongoing, and if it doesn't succeed, at least it's begun. At least it's begun with people who have credibility because they once were in charge of the government, and I don't think it will stop until finally we've gotten rid of these terrible things. They've simply become too dangerous, too easy to make copies of. The risk has become very real.
You spoke to Robert McNamara, former defense secretary, about why the United States built so many more nuclear weapons than it realistically needed during the Cold War. And he said, each individual decision along the way seemed rational at the time, but the result was insane. What was the nature of this supposedly rational process, and what was the nature of the insanity that resulted?
You know, I don't quite want to let Secretary McNamara off the hook with that remark. I'm not sure that even the individual decisions were quite rational when they were made. Mm-hmm. But he meant something like this, to take a real example. When he was working with the military, with the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense, the question came up of how many Minuteman missiles the United States should build. This was at the outset of the Minuteman program back in the early 1960s. The Air Force wanted 10,000. The Joint Chiefs of Staff took the Air Force recommendation and shaved it down to 3,000. McNamara had his own staff try to figure out how many missiles you would need to destroy enough of the Soviet Union's people and industry and cities that it could no longer conceivably respond. And his team came up with an estimate that 300 would be enough. Now,
and they wanted 10,000.
Well, the Air Force wanted 10,000. The Joint Chiefs were willing to ask for 3. So McNamara's own people say 300 is enough. So how did he resolve this conflict? Because this is, of course, a political problem as well as a technical problem. The Joint Chiefs have influence in Congress. They're not going to accept 300. That's not going to seem enough. And you have to balance all these different competing forces within the government. Well, he and John Kennedy sat down and decided that they could do with 600, that would be enough. But since Kennedy had campaigned on the argument that there was a missile gap between the United States and the Soviet Union, one of the reasons he was elected was because he claimed that, much to President Eisenhower's fury, because Eisenhower understood that we were building missiles faster than the Soviets at that point, that there indeed was no missile gap. Nevertheless, since the President, Kennedy, had campaigned on that clause, he felt that they would have to ask for more than 600. So they compromised on 1,000. And since there were already 54 Titan missiles deployed, we ended up with 1,054 ICBMs. Now, that's the way that seemingly precise number was arrived at. And that's the kind of so-called rational decision-making process. But I think those of us who aren't in government have to remember, as we think about these things and perhaps feel a little infuriated by them, just how complicated the whole thing is. For people who are elected to political office, like President Kennedy or President Eisenhower, you have to be prepared to defend your decisions in military issues against people who know that the easiest way to get votes is to scare the hell out of people. And in a way, the Cold War on both sides, not simply from the United States side, the Soviet side too, the Cold War was about leaderships, whether elected or simply climbed to power within the Soviet system, leaderships that used threat inflation and fear-mongering as a way to power. You can find this again and again throughout the Cold War. To just look at the American side, John Kennedy found a missile gap, and pretty soon there had been a so-called bomber gap. In the 1970s, President Reagan claimed that detente had ruined us and that the Soviets were actually ahead of us, and managed to get elected in 1980 on that platform. So it was a consistent thing that was used by both political parties throughout the Cold War as a way of taking power. Having then achieved election on that basis, then there was the requirement that they do something about it. So we ratcheted up our defense system basically for domestic political reasons, much more than for international reasons. There was, of course, always a reasonable concern. If the Soviets had so many weapons, then they must, at some military level, be planning to use them. And we needed to be prepared to defend ourselves against them, if that were possible. So there was a basis, in fact, for having something. But the use of fear and threat as a way of getting elected was a much more powerful driver of the levels of weapons during the Cold War than any real threat from the other side, particularly when you realize that the threat isn't something that you can defend against anyway.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about, which is what is missile defense, or is there even such a thing as defending oneself against a nuclear attack?
There isn't, and there never was, and there never can be. I quote a British prime minister from the early 30s in the context of bombing rather than ballistic missiles, but it's the same argument. Stanley Baldwin told the House, told Parliament in the early 1930s, the bomber will always get through. And General Curtis LeMay, when he came back from leading the firebombing of Japan at the end of the Second World War, told an audience in New York basically the same thing. LeMay then was soon responsible for inventing the Strategic Air Command, making it into the huge force of retaliation that it came to be in the 50s and 60s of the 20th century, and always understood that even if you knocked out 95%, a very high number to expect to do, of the Soviets' attacking forces, that would still mean that as many as 75 nuclear weapons would find their way into the United States, and 75 potential cities would be potentially destroyed. There's no way to protect against anything so small and portable as a nuclear weapon. Our smallest nuclear weapon weighed 52 pounds. Our smallest hydrogen bomb, with a yield of 5-10 times as much as Hiroshima, came to be a device about the size of a wastebasket that weighed about 200 pounds. You can't keep those things that small out. And under those circumstances, you're really whistling in the night to think that there's any military answer to a world where there are nuclear weapons. There is only a diplomatic and political solution to the problem. The great Danish physicist Niels Bohr understood this very early on simply because he understood how destructive these things were. He could do the numbers on the back of an envelope and see how big and dangerous they were going to be. And he phrased it in a single sentence. He said, "We are in an entirely new situation that cannot be resolved by war."
Well, I'm wondering if you could talk about that in terms of the current situation between the United States and Iran, this idea that there's not a military solution to safety and security, but only political solutions.
Yes, and let me speak of it in the context of what Mikhail Gorbachev came to when he finally realized that there was no point in having these vast arsenals on either side. He got the idea from a meeting that was held by the United Nations, a committee of the United Nations in the early 1980s, to try and understand if there was some other way past the Cold War than simply deterrence. And what this Swedish committee came up with was the idea of what it called common security. As Gorbachev would phrase it later in his meetings with Ronald Reagan, we can't be secure unless you're secure. We have to take into consideration not only our concerns for security, but also your concerns for security. Even if you're our enemy, we have to be sure that you are happy with the arrangements, or you're not going to abide by them, and they're not going to work. So both sides have to sit down, and this to go back to Niels Bohr. Bohr understood even before the end of the Second World War, before the first nuclear weapon had ever been exploded, that these things were so dangerous that the only answer was that they were sort of like an epidemic disease, or would be as they spread around the world. Countries as different as North Korea and the United States have cooperated in the past decades to eliminate smallpox from the world, and are presently cooperating to eliminate polio from the world. And people from either country and other countries are allowed freely to cross borders and to go back into secret places in order to eradicate every last possible trace of these epidemic diseases. There's an example in the public health world where a common danger has led people to sit down and agree that they should cooperate. Well, nuclear weapons are a common danger to the world as well. And if you think of them that way, you realize that we have better reason not to threaten Iran, which is simply encouraging them to move as quickly as possible to develop a few nuclear weapons of their own, but rather to discuss with them how to slow everything down and perhaps agree to reduce our own arsenals in the directions that we pledged we would ago when we signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It's very interesting to me to look back over the history of country after country going nuclear in the first part of the Cold War and realize that every time a country that we conceived of as an enemy approached becoming a nuclear power, starting with the Soviet Union, but then including China and moving on from there, we always had a great discussion of that these were madmen, that they were a danger to the world, that maybe we should go in and bomb their nuclear facilities before they use them. We seriously planned a preemptive war on the Soviet Union in 1954. It was staffed all the way up to President Eisenhower, who dismissed it out of hand and said, we don't do those things. We don't have Pearl Harbors in this country. We seriously considered bombing China's nuclear test range at Lop Nur in the weeks before they tested their first nuclear weapon in 1968, and so on and so on and so on. And so it doesn't surprise me that the same things are now being said about Iran, that Iran will somehow destroy the world if it acquires a few nuclear weapons, that they'll give them away to terrorists, if you can imagine such a thing, that a country that had built nuclear weapons would give them away to an entity over which it did not have total control. Impossible. And yet that's the sort of thing we're hearing right now with the interest from the neoconservatives and from the Dick Cheney part of our government in perhaps bombing Iran before the end of the Bush administration. Madness.
One section of your book is called Apes on a Treadmill, and it made me think about the experience of being an ape and that it's probably a lot easier to understand what or who an enemy is if you're an ape than if you're a politician or a military commander. And I wanted to ask you, what in this point in history constitutes an enemy? A person, a group, a culture, a religion, a nation, a way of life?
I'm not very good at identifying enemies or defining enemies, since I think that the first job of anyone in a position of responsibility in government is to look at the real reasons people do what they do. Let's take the current enemy of choice, the terrorist. You know, we fought against an enemy during the Second World War, Japan, that had what we would presumably today call suicide bombers, meaning the kamikaze pilots, who were all young, so-called fanatic young people who were willing to use their life to take out a lot of American lives on ships by flying planes that were essentially flying bombs, didn't even have wheels for the return flight because there was not going to be a return flight, flying them into our ships and causing mass havoc and terror among the Pacific Fleet at that time. Those people were doing something that's fundamentally rational from their point of view. And horrible as it is to say, I think we have to understand that terrorists are as well. They're simply leveraging their very small power against our very large power in the only way they've been able to figure out to do. I'm not condoning their violence any more than I think one should condone our violence in Iraq. But people don't act from pure, irrational, fanatic motives. They usually have at least a sheen of rationality about what they think they're doing. We certainly have tried to find a rationale for what seems to me to have been a most irrational war against Iraq. So if there is an enemy right now, it's certainly, I guess an enemy is properly defined as someone who wants to kill you. And that's certainly true of terrorist groups that have been fighting us in various ways. The question is, how do we put a stop to that? And I think the answer pretty clearly is you don't stop violence with violence. You simply don't. You escalate violence with violence, particularly when the people who are using the violence against you are not part of a centralized system of government. Governments control the violence within their jurisdictions more or less well, depending on how well they're organized. But if you're not a part of any organized government, as the Al-Qaeda groups are not, for example, their kind of violence is basically retaliatory violence. It's based on an old system that used to obtain in the West and still obtains in some parts of the world, where if someone attacks you, then you attack them. If you can't attack them, you attack their brother-in-law or their cousin or someone within their family or within their group, their tribe, whatever. that's the kind of system the terrorists are working under. And it's not going to work to attack them that way, because that simply means they feel they have to retaliate. Better would be to try to figure out what it is they need and then figure out what we can give them that they would accept and that they might give us in return some surcease from this particular threat.
I've often wondered about the cultural differences between people working in the world of weapons, especially nuclear weapons, and the rest of society, many of whom see, all the things you're talking about, even the words, you know, the need for nuclear war or the need for using these kind of weapons, as absurd or psychotic. You've been far closer to it than I or probably most of our listeners have ever been. What is the culture of weapons people like?
People at our labs, such as Los Alamos, or people in our military, are people who have accepted a responsibility that is handed to them by the government that we elect. Under those circumstances, I think they deserve all honor and credit. They're trying to do a job. If we have questions about whether that job is right or even good, it might well be an evil thing to do. The job comes from those people whom we have elected as our leaders, and they are the ones who should be held responsible. That said, I think whenever you find yourself working in a world that is protected from the rest of the world by a layer of secrecy, which is true with the labs and is true with the military where nuclear weapons are concerned, the risk always is that you become isolated and lose your connection with the rest of the civilian world, lose your sense of what is appropriate and inappropriate. It's very wonderful that former leaders of government, like the secretaries of state and others whom I mentioned, who are pursuing a program now of nuclear elimination, it's wonderful that they are, but it's also very interesting that they're all former government officials. Because when you're in government, basically, you have to follow the policies of your leaders. The irony is that the leader, whether it be Joseph Stalin or President Eisenhower or George W. Bush, leaders typically take their authority or claim to take their authority from the people. So you have a kind of circle where nobody is responsible.
Right.
The leader says, well, I'm here because the people chose me, or I'm here because the people wanted me to be here. I'm here because I found my way here, in the case of dictators of various kinds. But they evoke a larger principle, which is rather amorphous and which doesn't get to say no, as their authority for doing whatever they do. And then as you go down the line, the authority leads up to the people at the top. You're left with a situation where no one is really in charge in a terrible way, because some of the decisions that are made may well mean the destruction of a whole way of life, indeed the destruction of a whole group of people. So it's particularly tricky when people are responsible to up a hierarchy, up a chain of command, but ultimately the people at the top are the people who are responsible.
There's a significant portion of people in the United States who believe in the apocalypse and in the rapture. Does apocalyptic thinking play a role in the politics of nuclear weapons?
It certainly did in the case of Ronald Reagan. And it's very curious. You know, when he and Gorbachev came together at Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, at their famous two-day summit in October 1986, just 21 years ago, both of them arrived there with the full intention of figuring out a way of ending the nuclear arms race, which I think they basically did, but with the hope that they might somehow actually begin the elimination of all the nuclear weapons in the world. And Gorbachev came with his idea of common security, that the best way to be secure was to make sure your enemy was secure. That was the basis on which he could see slowly reducing or rapidly reducing nuclear arsenals. Reagan came with a very different perspective, and it might seem bizarre, but it gave him a basis in belief. and that was he had long ago equated the battle of Armageddon that is predicted in the book of Revelations, the last book in the Bible. He had long ago equated the battle of Armageddon with nuclear war. And he had come to believe that he was put on this earth, particularly after the near assassination that happened to him early in his presidency, when he barely survived, as we now know. He woke up from that horror saying, well, then I must really have been put on this earth to do something important because God saved me so that I could do it. He thought that if we could eliminate nuclear weapons, we could prevent the Battle of Armageddon from occurring, and therefore prevent the end of the world. He may not have noticed that that also would mean he would have prevented the second coming of Christ, but that's another question. Right. The point is, this deep belief motivated him in his movement toward eliminating the idea of eliminating nuclear weapons. So, oddly enough, Armageddon and the notion of a rapture and all those things, which he was fully aware of and a believer in, motivated him to try to do something that would have been absolutely wonderful for the whole world, in my judgment, and which we're now slowly beginning once again. The George Shultz Group actually took its lead from the Reykjavik summit. Shultz was there and was advising the president at that time, and it was in honor of the 20th anniversary that this idea that we should take the lead in developing a treaty through the United Nations that would eliminate all the nuclear arsenals. That's where the idea emerged from. So Reykjavik is still very much with us, whatever the motivation of the two leaders who negotiated there.
You talked a moment ago about the situation in which nobody feels that they're fully responsible because each person is entrusted by somebody else to make decisions. What do you think the role of the citizen is? Is it worth the efforts of people who are doing activism, who are doing media and education and so on, to discuss and discuss nuclear issues? What is the role of the citizenry, of the public?
The one time during the Cold War when a popular movement led to a major change in the nuclear arms race was early on when both sides were testing their nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. And the levels, particularly of strontium-90, were slowly building up around the world and were getting into the milk supply, which really bothered mothers everywhere because they were giving that milk to their babies. In fact, even breast milk had strontium-90 in it, maybe not at a dangerous level. That's another issue. But the fact that it was there really catalyzed a popular movement in the United States and elsewhere to eliminate atmospheric testing. And it happened. We moved to a treaty where all nuclear weapons had to be tested only underground. And that in itself was a nice non-proliferation move because testing underground costs a lot more than testing just by sitting a bomb on the ground and blowing it up. So it made it harder for countries to go nuclear or to develop new types of weapons if they had to go to all the trouble of drilling a tunnel 3,000 feet below the ground and all the things that went with that. That was a popular movement, but once that was done, we all kind of forgot, except for times of crisis when we were all frightened anew by the danger of possible nuclear war. But since the testing wasn't going on where we could see it and there wasn't any increased radiation levels in the atmosphere, we kind of went about our business. That was even more dramatically true when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991. Up to that time, if you took a poll of citizens in this country, number one on the list of their greatest concerns was the possibility of nuclear war. It dropped to number 25 in 1993 because and something like muggings in the street took over as number one. So it has been sort of out of sight and out of mind. And under those circumstances, there has been no citizen pressure for governments, our government, to do anything about the fact that we still have some 10,000 strategic nuclear weapons, and the Soviets, the Russians, some 15,000, far more than either side could possibly use. And anyway, who's the enemy? You certainly don't need 15,000 nuclear weapons to take on Iran or North Korea, God knows. So it's kind of been sitting there untouched for a long time. And the new movement of the Schultz group to try to get off our the dime we've been sitting on is a very healthy new development. At the same time, there's increasing pressure with the realization that terrorist groups might be able to, if they could get their hands on enough fissile material, might be able to make a homemade bomb or two. There's beginning to be increased pressure to take control of all the fissile materials in the world, to finish securing the materials that were rather poorly accounted for in the old Soviet Union, and generally to kind of wind down and get better control of all aspects of the nuclear cycle. So those are steps forward, but there's basically very little pressure right now from citizens for the governments of the world to do much about any of these issues. And I don't think they will do much unless there's more citizen pressure. So the short answer to the question is people need to be aware that the risk is still there, perhaps getting worse. The fact that the U.S. Air Force was able to fly 5 nuclear-tipped cruise missiles across the United States and not even realize that they had loaded them on the plane several weeks ago.
I know. What is up with that?
They were simply following a routine and not paying attention. They had cruise missiles with nuclear warheads in the particular bunker they went to, and they had cruise missiles without nuclear warheads, and they took the wrong missiles and put them on the plane to move them to another place because those particular cruise missiles are being destroyed. It was a mistake, but that's the kind of mistake that could mean the end of the human world.
Right.
That's the reason there should be no nuclear weapons in the world. That doesn't mean that we won't have deterrence if deterrence is of use. People will still know how to make them. It will just mean that it will take longer to deliver them from, let's say, a mothballed factory to target than it presently takes from a missile silo to target. And the longer you've got to think about whether you should use them, the better chance there is to find some alternative. So there's reason to get rid of them. It's possible to get rid of them. It would mean a much more open world if we got rid of them. You'd have to have unlimited rights of inspection everywhere in the world. One of the things that the Schultz Group has proposed is that a treaty banning nuclear weapons would declare the possession of a nuclear weapon to be a crime against humanity. That in itself would be, I think, a good taboo to impose on all these things. But the world would have to open up a lot more than it has. I mean, individual countries, including the United States, needless to say, to inspectors, to careful accounting for all nuclear materials, and many other aspects. It is, nevertheless, something that this group of experienced government officials believe to be possible. And I stress that because people don't have to believe me. These are people who have worked with these issues and been a part of these issues, and they seem to think it's possible. And that, I think, should be the hope of humanity right now.
And yet there is talk here in New Mexico of building, of upping the pit production at Los Alamos to make more triggers for nuclear weapons.
Yes, that's quite true. The debate that's going on right now has to do with whether we should stay with the weapons that were designed during the Cold War as what's left of our arsenal until such a time as we eliminate them all, or whether somehow those weapons were so sophisticated, pushed the margins so much, that somehow they won't be reliable in the future. Thus, the move by the Bush administration to develop something called a reliable replacement warhead that supposedly would be have a longer and more stable shelf life than the existing weapons. The studies that have been done by the National Academy of Sciences and by that special group of scientists called the Jason Group, which meets every year to look at special problems in and out of the nuclear part of the military. Everyone who's looked into this from outside the nuclear establishment, if you will, has said that the weapons we have are just fine. We don't know how long you're going to need to keep them anyway. Do you need to keep them for 10 more years or do you need to keep them for 50 more years? It's impossible to say. Better than to simply stay where we are rather than start production of another weapon with all the potential that's there for other countries like Iran or North Korea or some other country to say, you're building nuclear weapons. What right have you to tell us we shouldn't be building nuclear weapons? And I think the answer really has come from Congress, which has not funded the reliable replacement warhead program, other than the small amount of money necessary to keep it going at the level of theory. So right now, I think things are fairly stable. The question is, let's get off our dime and start moving toward eliminating nuclear weapons. And now there's an active movement on the part of former Republican government officials to do just that. I think that's an enormous step forward from where we were.
A lot of the metaphors surrounding the military and nuclear politics are about scales of maintaining the balance or tilting the balance, and it's an inherently delicate and unstable image. I wondered if you thought there were other metaphors, perhaps more stable, that could be employed to think about our relationship to other countries.
Well, I think the idea of common security is an absolutely clear and much more realistic view of where we are in the world now that we know how to release nuclear energy and weapons of war than was the old idea that this is somehow a balance or a delicate balance or that we're deterring or not deterring. The fact is, this new knowledge, like all human knowledge, has changed the relationship of countries and of people, has changed the relationship certainly of military power. If you can build small portable devices that are capable of destroying whole cities and capable of being hidden hidden in the back of a Jeep, if you will, or in the trunk of a car, or in the warhead of a cruise missile that travels so stealthily that no one even knows it's on its way until it arrives. If you can make such a weapon, and of course that's what we make, and that's what the Soviet Union made, and that's what Russia has and all the other nuclear powers, you're simply not in the same world you were in before. And I think that the metaphor that for me is most powerful in understanding what the problem is the metaphor derived from public health, of an epidemic disease or danger in the case of nuclear weapons that represents a common threat to us all. As such, we should all find ways to get together to deal with that common threat. And again, I use the example of the eradication of smallpox, which was accomplished in the early 1980s by a consortium through the World Health Organization of all sorts of nations. At the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was supplying all the vials of vaccine. The United States was supplying the money to pay for the vaccinators to go around the world to all the countries where there were smallpox outbreaks. Other countries were supplying the people. Other countries were supplying the vehicles and so forth. It was an international effort that everyone agreed needed to be done because you didn't want smallpox around anymore. It was too dangerous to all of us. So for me, if you think of nuclear weapons as a kind of epidemic disease, something, then I think you can begin to see why it isn't something that has anything whatsoever to do with who's more powerful, who's less powerful. The fact is, as Robert Oppenheimer, the first director of Los Alamos, wrote in the journal Foreign Affairs in 1953, he said something like, our 20,000th bomb isn't going to be of much use other than to fill an endless pipeline of bombs against their 5,000th bomb. Once you have a few of these things, that's all you really need to destroy effectively the political world of another country, much less the physical world. Therefore, to have so many is simply to court danger, to court risk, to court accident. And there have been accidents, and there have been close calls. There were a lot more close calls during the Cold War than we have heard of. I've been assured of that by people who know. I mentioned one in the book and describe one in the book that most people have never heard of. We came very close to an accidental nuclear war with the Soviet Union in November 1983 during Ronald Reagan's first term because Yuri Andropov, who was then the premier of the Soviet Union, seriously believed that the Reagan arms buildup could only have as its purpose the initiation of a nuclear war. Since the Soviet Union had just arrived at something like parity with the United States in terms of its nuclear armaments, Andropov couldn't understand why Reagan decided to double the United States defense budget. His conclusion was, we must be preparing for war. And in the fall of 1983, when there was a major NATO exercise taking place in Germany that included a practice run-up on a nuclear launch against the Soviet Union, Andropov, understandably, and his military, understandably, decided that maybe this was it, and raised their forces to a very high level of alert, loaded bombs onto planes in East Germany, got ready for a response. When President Reagan heard about all this, which he did belatedly in the middle of the exercise, he really was upset and understandably somewhat panicked and called it off and sent a message to Moscow, and generally both sides cooled it off. And that really was the beginning for Reagan of his realization we had to get rid of these things. There was no other solution than to somehow eliminate all the weapons. So for me, the metaphor is this is a disease, and we need to take precautions to eliminate it before it eliminates us.
And maybe someday they will, instead of having an arms race, they will have a chess championship race, or put our
well,
energy,
you know,
into something more productive.
The history of the last 100 years is a steady decline in the number and destructiveness of wars. The fact is, fewer and fewer people are being killed in each decade from war. There is a general and, I think, increasing feeling, reaching the point of becoming a belief, that war simply is not a very effective way to solve disputes. And I credit the discovery of how to release nuclear energy with that to some degree, because nuclear weapons put a cap on how far a country would go in fighting a war with its enemies, so-called. There was a limit. There didn't used to be a limit. You would fight until you won, but you can't win a nuclear war against a nuclear-armed opponent. Both sides are destroyed in the process. So there was suddenly a cap on how far any side could go. And I think that was the beginning of what is increasingly a sense that there's really not much return on fighting a war. I mean, it took a really belligerent president to decide that we had to go into war with Iran. And I think the only reason even he did so is because he believed it was a cakewalk, that it would be an easy way.
Do you mean Iraq?
I mean Iraq, that the president thought it might be an easy way to show our power in the Middle East at a time when things were most unstable there. Well, it was no cakewalk. It's turned out to be a quagmire instead. And I think if anything, it will leave the United States even more reluctant to go to war in the years ahead. At the same time, we saw all of Europe basically say, no, we don't want any part of your war. We saw the conflict with North Korea resolved by a particularly belligerent administration, I mean the Bush administration, resolved diplomatically and very successfully, basically by returning to the policy that the Clinton administration had been following before the Bush administration came in. There is every reason to believe that the only wars that are going to be fought in the years to come are going to be civil wars within countries, and I think even those are going to be wars that people from outside the United Nations and so forth is going to work hard to keep under control and even to prevent and to stop. It's in a world as interconnected as our world has become, it's simply not good business, among other things, for people to be fighting and killing each other.
Well, on that note, Richard Rhodes, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.